It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, listeners, before we jump into this episode, we just want to give out a special shout to a Augur level patron on Patreon, Peggy.
Peggy.
Peggy. Marissa loves you. And we do, too.
We all love you, Peggy.
Welcome to Dig, a history podcast.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
That's right. For this installment of our Frontiers series, we are metaphorically climbing aboard the Starship Enterprise to explore the vast reaches of the galaxy. We're not actually exploring outer space. We are not actually qualified for
that. Yeah, we're humanities professors. You'll have to get all that STEM stuff elsewhere.
Right. What we're actually talking about today was, however, inspired by Captain James Tiberius Kirk's famous opening lines in that beloved television and film series, Star Trek. Is space the new frontier? What are the links between the so-called age of exploration and conquering of the Old West and the United States space program? I'm Sarah.
And I'm Avril.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
We are so thankful for all the individuals and businesses who've supported this podcast. And today we want to give a special shout out to the farmers who own Cabot Creamery Cooperative. Some of you may know that I have been side hustling for the Cabot Marketing Department for over a decade. And so these folks are really near and dear to my heart. But all of us at Dig only buy Cabot cheese because we know that it's going to be delicious, but also because we know we're supporting a really wonderful business model, this cooperative model, with 100% of profits going back to the farmers. And as of 2019, the Cabot Co-op will have been around for 100 years. To make it through another 100, they will continue to invest in sustainability. Cabot makes the world's best cheddar. That's a given. But it was also the first dairy to earn a B Corp certification. Our farmers are committed to good land stewardship, and they're committed to all the communities and the people where they work and farm. Every Cabot dairy product that you purchase ensures the future and the next 100 years of every farm family from New York and New England who make up our co-op. You can go to the Cabot website, cabotcheese.coop, to sign up for e-cheese, to get recipes and coupons, to learn about our gratitude department, or to get more information about visiting one of our retail stores where you can sample every flavor of cheese for free. That's cabotcheese.coop. Thank you, Cabot Farmers, for supporting Dig a History Podcast.
Before we get started, we want to extend a major thank you to Anna Razor. I really hope that I'm saying your last name properly, Anna, one of the amazing historians of Lady Science, which is a magazine and podcast devoted to issues of gender, science, and technology in history. Anna is working on a PhD right now on the history of the American Space Program and helped me so much in locating the readings for this episode. We are relying largely on just one book this time. It's called Space in the American Imagination by Howard McCurdy, solely on Anna's recommendation. So thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you, Anna. Also, we just want to draw your attention to our brand new Patreon account. If you want to throw us a few bucks to help us support this podcast, we'd appreciate it. We are working toward a $300 a month goal. And once we do that, we will finally get a new recording setup so that Marissa and Elizabeth can stop complaining about having to stand while we record.
They're babies.
They are babies.
We don't think about imagination all that much as historians. We think about what people thought. We think about what they believed. But at least in my work, I don't often think about what people might have imagined. But our imagination is actually incredibly important to how we decide to shape our society. For instance, there was a time in the United States when most people, most white people anyway, believed that slavery was just part of the fabric of society. It was just so baked in that many people couldn't really fathom that there might be a different way. How did that start to change? Well, one element, argues Howard McCurdy, was that abolitionist literature, including novels like Uncle Tom's Cabin, helped people to imagine something different. In other words, fiction and pop culture helped people to envision an alternate universe. With the help of these imagination aids, they could suddenly see not only the horrible realities of bondage, but also a future that did not include the enslavement of Black Americans.
As McCurdy argues, no policy can long exist in a political culture in which popular beliefs and myths question its feasibility. In other words, if it seems utterly absurd to us, then it's not possible for some visionary change maker to go out and implement some policy that will change the world. It's doomed to fail. Another example McCurdy gives us is laws to alleviate poverty. For a long time, centuries, most people believed that poverty was impossible to fix. Some people were poor, some people were rich. Why bother helping poor people? Ebenezer Scrooge.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How he says, like, well, if they're going to die, they better do it and decrease the surplus population, right? Aren't there prisons? Aren't there poorhouses? Why are we going to bother, like, helping them with charity? Because they're just going to be poor anyway.
Right. But when the works of Charles Dickens, for instance, started to show people that impoverished people were just like them, with families and hopes and dreams, it helped average people to believe that maybe policies meant to fix poverty could do something worthwhile.
Or, for instance, conservation, which we've actually talked about before in our series on environmental history. Americans typically thought about nature as something that needed to be tamed or controlled by humans, particularly in order to make it productive. This could mean anything from logging to clear cutting to make way for farms. This is something that still bothers me all the time. We all live sort of in a suburban sort of area, mm-hmm. And I live in an area where it's maybe a little bit more open space, and I'm constantly upset when I see, like, farmland that's being turned over and made into yet another development. It just bothers me all the time. But wilderness for a long time in the United States was seen as something to be feared and brought under human control. But over the course of several decades during the 19th century, artists and writers helped Americans to think about the wilderness in different ways. For instance, the paintings of landscape artists like Thomas Cole, Albert Bierstadt, and Thomas Moran. Moran was actually so successful at capturing the beauty of the untouched American landscape that Congress purchased $25,000 worth of his paintings to display inside the Capitol building in the 1870s. Alongside art was the writing of men like Henry David Thoreau and James Fenimore Cooper and John Muir, who helped Americans to imagine the beauty of places they had never and probably would never see, and helped them to imagine seeing it with their own eyes. The ability to imagine these places made Americans attached to them and to start to think of them as something somehow important to the American landscape, a feeling that they translated into a desire to protect them through protective policies. So this also kind of makes me think today of television shows that we've had, you know, maybe in the 10 or 15, 20 years ago through the 90s and early 2000s that had gay characters on them, right? And like, as Averill has pointed out, like, they're flawed characters, right? They're not, like, Will and Grace is not maybe the most perfect depiction of gay men, right? But they've helped to sort of give Americans, especially Americans who don't know gay people, a different way of thinking about gay people, right? And there have been some people who have argued that that kind of visibility really helped to usher in a period where people were willing to support gay marriage laws because they felt like they weren't afraid of gay people. They didn't have misunderstandings about gay people anymore. Does that make sense?
Yes. Also, I thought of a good one.
Okay.
Tara and Willow in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right? That's a great one.
And like science fiction is unique because that generally happens earlier than mainstream TV.
Yeah.
Particularly like the sexual relationship between Tara and Willow, because it's already like Star Trek pushing the boundaries of normalized society, that it's almost like more acceptable. So Joss Whedon was able to make this really intense sexual relationship between Willow and Tara long before you could have seen that on something like Ellen shows.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, I'm not saying that they were the change maker, of course, but what I am saying is what McCurdy is trying to point out is that sometimes pop culture or art or literature can help us to imagine things that we wouldn't be able to think of on our own, right? Like it kind of like sows the, what am I looking for? It kind of makes for fertile ground, right? Mm-hmm. That like, okay, now I've watched this, I've watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer and I like these people. Well, gay people must not be that bad, right? Like they're just kind of normal, or I like these characters, right? I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
You are the worst.
I'm sorry.
I've never seen Murphy Brown.
What? Okay. Anyway, this process of learning how to imagine something unimaginable was central to the movement to establish an American space program in the middle of the 20th century. Without getting the public to believe that space travel might be possible and to imagine what wonders might be beyond our atmosphere, there would be no public support for an incredibly expensive and time-consuming government program. Space boosters, as they called them, used popular magazines and influenced the creation of other cultural products, such as science fiction books, magazines, comics, movies, and television shows, to help Americans envision a space program. Now, I want to pause here just to say that this is a tricky process. Sometimes these so-called space boosters, in other words, folks who really wanted to see space exploration get funding and support, sometimes they actually created this content, and we'll give you many examples. But other times they acted as expert consultants or helped content creators to create shows and movies. And other times they just sort of set the stage for cultural content to happen on its own, right? This was especially common later in the 20th century as the space program really got underway. Screenwriters often looked to the realities of the space program for material, even without the urging of individual boosters.
In fact, some of the fathers of modern space exploration were themselves inspired by science fiction. Robert Goddard, the American engineer who built the very first liquid-fueled rocket, and the man for whom the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center is named. Hermann Oberth, the German physicist, and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the Russian rocket scientist, were all fans of Jules Verne, of course. Jules Verne, of course, was the mid-19th century French novelist who wrote science-inspired fiction, such as Around the World in 80 Days, From the Earth to the Moon, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Verne wrote what at first glance seemed like fanciful adventures, but they were actually based on some scientific research, and he took great pains to make his adventures seem plausible. For instance, in From the Earth to the Moon, he calculated the velocity that would be needed to launch his characters to the moon. Where science hadn't yet progressed, he just used his imagination to spice up technology that already existed. For instance, he had his characters travel to the moon in a rocket that was launched by a giant cannon.
Which, you know, makes sense if you put yourself sort of in Jules Verne's shoes, because cannons were something that existed and could project things for many, you know, for long distances. So,
yes,
it seems very preposterous.
The explosion wouldn't kill you.
Correct.
Surely.
No, it wouldn't. It's fiction, Avril.
I know.
Herman Oberth was born in 1894 and grew up on a steady diet of Verne's space stories, reading them, quote, 5 or 6 times until he finally knew them by heart. Oberth went on to study mathematics and physics, earned a PhD, and spent his life trying to solve the problem of spaceflight. In 1923, he published a book called, in English, The Rocket in Planetary Space, which was an interesting blend of complex scientific theories and imaginative creative ideas about what humans could do once in space. It was a huge hit, and just a few years later, Oberth acted as a consultant on the film By Rocket to the Moon, a Fritz Lang film about space travel that was based on his theories. Now, Lang was an incredibly famous filmmaker. For context, he had just come off of Metropolis, one of the first feature-length science fiction films ever, which was vastly ambitious and is still considered an incredibly important piece of film history. Such literature and films about space helped to spread the idea that space exploration might actually be possible. And since they were based on real scientific research, they weren't pure fantasy. As a result, during the period roughly after World War I through to the 1950s, societies began to form with the intent of advocating for space exploration.
There's another reason why excitement for space travel began to grow. People began to believe that the Earth no longer held place for exploration. Sarah did an episode during our last series all about polar exploration. Arctic exploration was full of adventure and danger and was just the kind of thing that newspapers loved to publish because it brought in readers. But Arctic exploration was more or less out because in 1905, Roald Amundsen finally discovered a Northwest Passage. Even before that, the major European quests to explore Africa had ended, such as Henry Stanley's trip down the Congo River in 1877. Increasingly, people believed that there weren't any more frontiers. Space seemed like it might be the last remaining unexplored territory.
Now, I think we probably all already know and agree that this was really not true, as SeaQuest, another excellent, television show. Not really. It's absolutely horrible and I hate it. As SeaQuest tried to show us in the 1990s and Blue Planet in the 2000s, we really do not know very much about the oceans. And that is a place where could be considered a frontier that we really should be exploring more. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Yukon, the Himalayas, the South Pole, et cetera, all had exploratory missions happening during this same time period that there was supposedly no frontier. And of course, one of my favorite explorations that I think is really wild is some explorations of the Amazon that happened in the 1910s, including one that was undertaken by former President Theodore Roosevelt in 1913 and 1914, which went disastrously, disastrously bad. All this to say that it's not really totally accurate to say that space was the final frontier at the beginning of the 20th century. There's plenty of other stuff to explore. Yeah. But it seemed to people at the time that everything had been done.
As the recent acclaimed film Smallfoot evidence, there are still yetis in the Himalayas yet to be discovered.
Yes.
Yes.
You're right. Expeditions like all of those didn't just have scientific importance. They also became a form of mass entertainment. Newspapers followed the exploits of famous adventurers closely and even took on stunts themselves to sell papers. Nellie Bly, for instance, set out in 1888 to beat Jules Verne's suggested 80 days for a trip around the world. Bly, writing up her adventures for the New York World, made it around the world in 72 days. Space boosters began to sell space exploration as the next step in human exploration. Philip Cleeter, the founder of the British Interplanetary Society, wrote in 1936, quote, "The spirit of adventure, the lure of the unknown, will attract man to Mars just as surely as they caused him to penetrate into the wilds of Africa and the solitude of the polar regions." Just got to pause there. Ooh, is that interesting language?
Sex.
That they caused man to penetrate into the wilds of Africa. Very, like, conquering, rapey language there, right?
Also hot to cold. Africa to the polar.
Sure. Right. That's not really what my brain was thinking. Space travel then started to seem to the public like something analogous to those polar adventures we talked about before. McCurdy calls this the, quote, small ships and brave men image of scientific exploration. In other words, space exploration was made to fit into a pre-existing narrative of travel, adventure, and exploration, one that average people were already primed to consume. And I just want to say, you know, on Facebook, there are those like ads for like t-shirts that have funny sayings on them all the time. They're like targeted to you. I found one that I have to buy for my husband, who's a huge fan of both literature about like the tall ships era and obsessed with Star Trek. And it hit the shirt says, too late for tall ships, too soon for spaceships. So it sees, we even see this kind of in culture today, this kind of connection between the two.
I think that Google Ads just showed you that because they knew you were writing this copy.
No, I saw this like years ago. But
In the early days, one challenge facing boosters was trying to give Americans a frame of reference for space flight. What would it look like? How would it work? So starting in 1951, the Hayden Planetarium in New York City organized several symposia on space travel. The speakers were scientists and researchers, but the organizers purposely invited newspapers and magazines, hoping to spread the message. Organizers felt confident that space travel would develop eventually without the boosters, but they worried first that it would develop only as an offshoot of the military and would therefore be potentially weaponized rather than developed as a scientific inquiry, or that it would develop very, very slowly. The only way around that, they felt, was by getting the public on board. If average folks were excited about space exploration's potential, they would pressure their representatives to take the venture seriously. Of course, this meant getting information about space travel to the public in an accessible, fun way. And doesn't this sound a little bit like what we're doing with this podcast? Trying to convince people that history is actually important? And that maybe they should support the work of historians?
Just saying.
Just saying. And magazines that were very interested in helping to bring that message to the public, like Collier's, which had a circulation of 3.1 million readers, partnered with symposium organizers to publish an 8-part series on space exploration. The articles were accompanied by paintings by Chelsea Bonestell? Bonestell?
Bonestell.
A painter who was known for his ability to illustrate planets, space, and rockets. You may not have heard of Bonestell, but you'll definitely recognize his work. It has a sort of iconic mid-century modern look to it. I assume we'll post some in the copy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But seriously, when you see them, you'll be like, oh, okay. Like, you probably can't call it to mind right now. You probably don't recognize his name. But when you see it, it's pretty iconic. The Collier series led to another way that boosters were able to sell the idea of space exploration, through the power of Disney. Walt Disney was in the final stages of planning Disneyland. The park was going to be organized around 4 themed sections: Adventureland, Frontierland, Fantasyland, and Tomorrowland. Most of those themes were fairly well fleshed out, except for Tomorrowland. Disney also planned to release a television series to promote the park, but the Tomorrowland segments were causing the writing team problems. One of Disney's senior animators, Ward Kimball, had followed the Collier's series closely and reached out to the boosters behind that series, writer Willie Ley, aerospace engineer Werner Von Braun, and physicist Heinz Haber. The result was an impressive combination of animation, real footage, and science instruction. It's really something else, and I will link it in the show notes. You gotta watch some of it. It's so great. But it combines both the concrete reality of the technology that scientists already have, what they're experimenting on, and what is possible down the road. It's a combination of science and imagination, but with this kind of sense of practicality. It's futuristic, but not fantastical. Wernher von Braun actually states on the show that if we were to start today on an organized and well-supported space program, I believe a practical passenger rocket could be built and tested within 10 years. He was creepily accurate. The first three-stage rocket with astronauts on board launched just 13 years later.
Fortune teller and scientist.
Indeed.
Did you ever watch that movie, Tomorrowland?
Yes, it has... Made?
George Clooney?
Yes, I do. I did.
Yeah?
I don't remember anything about it.
Oh.
I didn't think it was that good.
Yeah. Okay, just wondering. So, in addition to this, that's not all that came out of the collaboration between Disney and the Space Boosters. They did produce several more installments about space travel between 1955 to 1957, but they also collaborated on the actual rides in the Tomorrowland Park at Disneyland.
Isn't that cool?
So cool. The park was supposed to depict America in the year 1986. A great year. That's the year I was born.
Oh.
So was there a little baby me there?
No, yes, there was.
Oh, there was?
Yeah. No, there was a little toddler me there.
Oh, you weirdo.
Because I'm old.
Probably being like Zoe and destroying
trashing
everything.
Trashing stuff, yeah.
Although there were no crimpers or acid wash jeans or leg warmers in sight.
Sadly, no.
Wernher von Braun, you let us down.
Get it together.
In the center of the park was an 80-foot tall, needle-nosed rocket ship, which had been designed under the direction of Leigh and von Braun. As visitors moved through the park, they viewed a short film about space travel, then entered a room that was supposed to be the inside of the rocket, where screens on the floor and the walls made it seem as though they were traveling through space. Later that year, Disney added a model space station on the recommendation of Leigh and von Braun, where visitors could look down on the planet Earth and watch the United States go from dawn to dusk.
Now, if you've ever seen Star Trek, you know that the original series is essentially an extended allegory on the Cold War. The Federation represents the NATO countries, while the Klingons are the dangerous, chaotic, uncivilized Soviets. And if you know anything about the development of the United States space program during the mid-20th century, you know that it was, in large part, sped along by the quote-unquote space race against the Soviet Union. But it wasn't a simple process. Dwight Eisenhower, hero of World War II and president in the 1950s, endorsed space travel, but wasn't sold on sending humans into space for scientific exploration. First, he was worried about the continued growth of what he famously termed the military-industrial complex, but he also worried that it was a waste of money and resources. Instead of manned space exploration, and I'm going to pause here just for 1 second. I tried to be very careful about my use of the term manned, like manned space exploration. Mm-hmm. It may slip out occasionally because that's how they referred to it.
Mm-hmm.
I tried not to use that phrase, though. So instead of quote-unquote manned space exploration, he wanted the newly established National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, to concentrate on satellite technology, especially after the Soviets launched Sputnik 1 in October 1957. NASA did not focus exclusively on satellite technology, as Eisenhower hoped, and continued to research what they called, again, manned space travel, but also found that during this time of heightened national security concerns, it wasn't good enough to sell the program using Disney magic. Now, space travel had to appear to be key to winning the Cold War.
Space, and the moon in particular, suddenly became the high ground of the Cold War. This is referring to the law in military science that it's tactically important to hold the ground.
As you just learned on your trip to Gettysburg when we were on Little Round Top.
Honestly, I didn't listen to a word that man said. But it makes logical sense.
It does.
Yeah, I'm not so stupid. I would win.
You probably would.
In a battle.
I'm not going to lie, you probably
would. I would be a magnificent general. But that's in a future life, like in the next 5 to 7 years. In a 1946 issue of Collier's, writer G. Edward Pendray wrote, "So far as sovereign power is concerned,
Control of the moon in the interplanetary world of the atomic future could mean military control of our whole portion of the solar system. Its dominance could include not only the Earth, but also Mars and Venus, the two other possibly habitable planets. Pendre went further, saying that the moon may be the fortress of the next conqueror of the Earth.
Yikes.
Soon, outlets were reporting that the moon was a potential launch site for nuclear weapons, stoking fears rather than exciting imaginations. Eisenhower was not excited about this because it seemed to point the space program in the direction he most resisted: potential weaponization and manned spaceflight. But in the end, it was his successor, John F. Kennedy, who shaped the American space program. By 1965, NASA's budget had increased tenfold to a whopping $5.3 billion, with the goal of sending a rocket with people in it to the moon.
I want to come back to a quote that you just mentioned, Avril, from science fiction writer G. Edward Pendre. Pendre explicitly referred to the conquest of space, which is a particularly telling word choice. Our series here is, after all, on frontiers, and as students of history, we know that often the exploration of new lands and frontiers involves conquest or colonization of those places and the peoples that inhabit them. And space boosters often linked space exploration with the age of exploration, or the period roughly the 1400s to the 1600s, where Europeans were increasingly interested in ocean exploration. For example, a comic book made with the support of NASA to explain spaceflight to children explained that space exploration was basically the same thing as Christopher Columbus's voyage to the quote-unquote New World. It read, "Just as Christopher dreamed about opening a new trade route to the Far East, we can dream about a clean and beautiful Earth and about other space routes to Mars and colonization of our neighbor, the moon." I think that quote is even more telling because not only does it invoke Columbus, but also refers explicitly to the colonization of the moon. Because after all, those explorers weren't exploring solely for the sake of science, but for the establishment of empires.
Oh, but that's not the only Columbus reference. In 1986, the National Commission on Space issued a report to describe the goals of space exploration in the 21st century, and they opened with this. 5 centuries after Columbus opened to access the New World, we can initiate the settlements of worlds beyond our planet of birth. The promise of virgin lands and the opportunity to live in freedom brought our ancestors to the shores of North America. Now space technology has freed humankind to move outward from Earth as a species destined to expand to other worlds.
Now you sound like a Klingon.
Well, Soviet. The same report featured an image of several astronauts in futuristic gear watching in the distance as a rocket blasts off from what appears to be a space station. In the black space above the image are the words, "Pioneering the Space Frontier." Of course, the word pioneer is supposed to evoke something for Americans. Our pioneers were the men and women who courageously traveled across the great expanses of the Midwest to settle unknown territories. The heroes that we grew up with from Little House on the Prairie and that sad, sad experience of the Oregon Trail.
Right. Now, side note, after I had my first baby, there were all these doctors and nurses and pediatricians kept telling me and my husband both that I was pioneer stock because apparently I was good at having babies and Ainsley was really good at eating. So apparently that means that we're pioneer stock. And so to this day, my husband likes to call me, likes to say that I'm upstate New York farm stock because I've got breeding hips.
So we should send you first to the moon.
Yes.
To live there.
Because I am pioneer stock.
You
right?
and your baby mm-hmm. will survive the wilderness.
Right. We will.
Yep.
It wasn't just about Columbus, though. NASA Administrator James Beggs said that Americans had always been driven to, quote, chart new paths. He said this, quote, "That instinct that drove Lewis and Clark to press across the uncharted continent, It guided Admirals Perry and Byrd to the icy wastes of the poles. It drove Lindbergh alone nonstop across the Atlantic and sustained 12 Americans as they walked on the moon. If we ever lose this urge to know the unknown, we would no longer be a great nation. Now, I find this last phrase absolutely fascinating because it sounds like a space age version of something that all American historians are familiar with, the work of Frederick Jackson Turner. Frederick Jackson Turner, historical hottie, BT dubs, was an American historian working during the Gilded Age Progressive Era. He earned a PhD from Johns Hopkins, then went to work and teach at the University of Wisconsin, and then later at Harvard. Turner is most remembered now for a lecture that he gave at the meeting of the American Historical Association at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Now, I always think this is kind of funny because nobody remembers anything that anyone says at the AHA anymore.
It's true.
I'm exaggerating, but like, it's not a place where you give like an earth-shattering speech. Like, there's 5 million panels and everyone says something that's good, and then you go home and you sleep it off. Like, it just makes me laugh. Anyway, so the paper that he delivered was called The Significance of the Frontier in American History, and I should say it's later published as a book. It argued that the existence of a frontier was critical to the development of the American character. The shortest version is that as American pioneers moved across the continent, they became less and less European in their character and thus became more democratic. Part of this theory is that the further they got from the quote-unquote civilization of the East Coast, the more that American character intensified, to the point where people in the far West, Turner would argue, were wild, they were more violent, they were more individualistic, and sort of more savage. But the core of Turner's thesis, and the part that stuck in the American imagination, was the idea that frontiers were critical to an exceptional American character. He's talking about American exceptionalism, right? Without a frontier, what would set Americans apart? When James Beggs said that without the urge to explore the unknown, we would no longer be a great nation, he was applying the Turner thesis to space exploration.
Clearly, this Turner fella didn't read any Amish romance.
I don't think he did.
Because he would know that they kept their Europeanness and moved to Mexico with it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll link to that in the show notes, too. There's another part of Turner's thesis that sunk into the popular mindset. Turner argued that the frontier had closed in 1890. The 1890 census showed that most large tracts of land, or what constituted the frontier, according to Turner, had been broken up. And by what, you ask? Why, barbed wire. Barbed wire allowed ranchers to divide their land, meaning that the frontier was broken up into individual plots rather than open space. Turner's theory was not only that frontier had been critical to the creation of the American character, but that the lack of a frontier was foreboding for America's future. What would become of a people forged by frontier when the frontier disappeared? Turner wasn't alone in his worries about this. Teddy Roosevelt had his own similar theory about the frontier and the American character, except his was a bit more violent.
I mean, of course.
Because he's Teddy. Right. He believed that it wasn't just moving west, but conquering the west. Americans had become a powerful, masterful, read masculine,
right,
society by taking the Western lands from Native Americans by force. Now that the frontier was closed and the major conflicts with tribes like the Lakota and Cheyenne were over, there was no one left to conquer in the United States. And Roosevelt worried that the American character would become soft and effeminate. He does suggest that maybe we can solve this problem with football and hunting,
mm-hmm,
but eventually suggests in his famous strenuous life speech that what we need is to conquer other peoples and other lands. In other words, join European nations in establishing an empire. Roosevelt, of course, had his eye specifically on places like Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. In other words, the essence of the American character that needs the frontier to remain vital can be saved as long as we keep finding new places to explore and conquer.
Mm-hmm. So this is what is so fascinating to me about the use of Turner's thesis in space boosterism, is that it often includes this second idea that Americans were made to conquer. G. Edward Pendray's warning that the moon could potentially be the launch site of the, quote, next conqueror of Earth has really strong parallels to the rhetoric of the Gilded Age and Progressive Era language about colonization. If we don't act now to get involved in Cuba, Teddy Roosevelt was saying in 1899, some other European nation is going to outstrip us. In the 1950s, the implication was that if Americans didn't act really fast to control the moon, someone else was going to get there first. I mean, and the someone else being the Soviets, right? With potentially devastating consequences. It also translates into increasing discussion of not just exploring space or traveling through space, but colonizing space using moon bases or space stations. In the 1960s, NASA organized several studies on the creation of moon bases. The Apollo program, the NASA initiative to put a human on the moon, was seen as sort of the first step in what would eventually, for some, be a project to establish permanent presence on the moon. Many people just assumed that that's where this was going, that we would send someone to touch the moon, right? Just like, oh, moon. And then, like, it would, like, progress to the point where we would stay, have a permanent presence on the moon. One suggestion was to place a module on the moon with enough supplies for astronauts to live for about 90 days, with more permanent shelters following after that. By the late 1980s, NASA theorized, lots of big things happening in the 80s, apparently.
It's the 80s.
Yeah. There would be a permanent colony living on the moon. This never happened, of course, and we'll get to why that is towards the end of the episode.
Others had even more ambitious plans. Gerard O'Neill, a physics professor, started brainstorming space colonization with his students at Princeton University in the early 1970s. Eventually, he published his ideas in an article for Physics Today. His plan included long tables.
No.
Nope, long tubes. Where they would gather and have a Thanksgiving long feast. His plans included long tubes, 16 miles long and 4 miles in diameter, that would replicate Earth's environment, but floating in the emptiness of space. Animals and humans would live together, just like on Earth, just without bugs, hopefully. You know, they couldn't stop the bugs from coming. The bugs are always going to come.
But, yeah. I mean, isn't that like a subgenre of science fiction, right?
There's
like,
always bugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Within a few decades, he argued, these colonies could house up to 1.2 billion people. O'Neill's vision led to the creation of a new wave of space booster organizations like the L5 Society. The L5 Society took its name from the location in between the Earth and the Moon, L5, or Langragian 5, where if a small object existed, would stay put on that orbital path, kept stable by the gravitational pull of the two larger bodies, the Earth and the Moon. The group was devoted to O'Neill's vision of space colonization, and it actually had a little bit of political influence in the late 1970s when, to make a long story short, they helped to convince the United States Senate not to ratify the so-called Moon Treaty, which would have made the moon an internationally recognized neutral entity. In other words, it would have made it illegal, under international law, for one state to colonize the moon or the moon's orbit. L5 wanted to see O'Neill's floating space colony become a reality, so they did not want the Moon Treaty to be ratified. If it did, it would make space colonization much less likely. The L5 Society wasn't alone, though. McCurdy argues that, actually, the cancellation of Star Trek in 1969, which had helped to stoke the space imaginations of thousands of Americans, made people flood into space booster organizations to help their space fantasies become realities. By 1980, there were about 40 organizations, all devoted to space exploration or colonization, all ready to help be space boosters. They actually had some clout, too. In the late 1970s, a letter-writing campaign from Trekkies helped to convince Gerald Ford to name a test shuttle Enterprise.
Now, I got very excited about this as I was writing it, and I went out and was telling my husband all about it. My husband is a huge, huge Trekkie. I mean, he's just a over the top, knows everything about Star Trek. He's just obsessed, right? He's a huge Trekkie. Mm-hmm. So I was telling him about this, and he knew all about this letter writing campaign to Gerald Ford. He was like, oh yeah, absolutely. And so he told me this story, and forgive me, Trekkies out there, if I'm butchering this, but he told me this story about how in, I think it's in Star Trek, the motion picture, the first one that comes out in 1979, I believe. I think it's that one. There is on the, they're in some like room at the Starfleet headquarters. Mm-hmm. There's a wall that shows all of the Enterprises. You know how there have been different iterations of the Enterprise? It goes all the way back to this Enterprise. Mm. So he said that it's like a thing in Star Trek communities of fans that they actually, it's this like cyclical sort of logic, right? Where like they convinced Gerald Ford to make the first test shuttle the Enterprise, which then gets written into Star Trek, the Star Trek universe, as the first Enterprise, and thereby they're sort of creating that future.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And of course, I mean, people don't actually believe that, like, Starfleet is coming, but, like, there are some people who have looked at Space Force and said, maybe this is the first step towards Starfleet. I don't believe that of this president. I don't think that he would come up with something quite as peaceful and magnanimous as Starfleet. I don't think that's what his vision is for Space Force, but
who's him?
Who do you think him? This president?
Oh, that's don't pay attention.
Oh, have you heard of Space Force?
No, I thought you were talking maybe about Elon Musk. Cause
no. I mean, that's a whole different thing. But no, I mean like the President Trump's like creation of Space Force, and some Trekkies are like, ah, it's the beginning, it's the seed of what might end up being a something like Starfleet.
No.
But I don't believe that he has that in mind.
No.
He's thinking of weaponizing, right?
Right.
Okay, anyway. The Turnerian vision of space as frontier took a different form in the mind of Carl Sagan, the famous scientist and writer. Sagan was immensely talented, of course, on a number of levels, but he was particularly talented at translating complex scientific principles into ideas that average people could understand, much in the same way that I think maybe Neil deGrasse Tyson or Bill Nye is today. In 1980, Sagan hosted the 13-part PBS series Cosmos, which, much like those Disney films of the 1950s, blended scientific instruction with animation to explain outer space and space exploration to average people. Because of Cosmos, Sagan became sort of a public intellectual with an incredibly huge following. I don't know about you, we had many Carl Sagan books in my house growing up. My uncle was a huge Carl Sagan fan. He was part of my childhood. In 1994, Sagan published his second-to-last book, Pale Blue Dot, A Vision of the Human Future in Space. In Pale Blue Dot, Sagan makes a very Turnerian argument that humans were, at their core, wanderers. Humans had been wandering when they crossed the Bering Strait to populate North America, and they'd been wandering when they crossed the Atlantic for the first time, and they'd been wandering when the pioneers crossed the American plains in covered wagons. But in recent human history, he argues, we lost our wandering spirit. He wrote this, quote, for all its material advantages, the sedentary life has left us edgy, unfulfilled, while the open road still softly calls like a forgotten song.
Very poetic.
Yes.
As Sagan builds his theory, he sounds more and more like a science fiction Frederick Jackson Turner. This urge to explore is a survival instinct, he suggests, something that we're compelled to do as a part of our Darwinian nature. So, he says, we've hemmed ourselves in, and all the while, something inside of us is aching to get back out on the road and wander. At the same time, Sagan also muses that humanity is suffering from something like growing pains, or maybe maturing pains. For most of human existence, humans created cosmologies to explain the universe to themselves, and to give them comfort that all of this added up to something, or had a larger meaning. To use a Christian interpretation, that God created all of what we know and see, each of us in his image, and for a particular purpose. Science, Sagan says, has blown this out of the water, causing humanity real anxiety. We're all just sort of random chemistry accidents. Sagan suggests that, quote, humans cannot live with such a revelation, and that reality has bred a sense of hopelessness. What could cure this discontent? Well, space exploration, of course. He offers this suggestion. Once we overcome our fear of being tiny, we find ourselves on the threshold of a vast and awesome universe that utterly dwarfs in time, in space, and in potential, the tiny anthropocentric proscenium of our ancestors. In other words, once we get over ourselves and start to explore this vast universe, we'll fix both problems. We'll get back our wandering nature and fill ourselves with renewed awe.
One very interesting addendum to Sagan's pale blue dot is that historian Howard McCurdy argues that his assessment of humanity's general discontent was maybe pretty accurate, although his explanation of it might have been a little embellished. Although Pale Blue Dot is published in 1994, Sagan seems to be responding to the very real malaise that affected the United States in the 1970s, which Jimmy Carter famously pointed out in a televised speech given July 15, 1979, in which he stated that America was, quote, lacking confidence and a sense of community and was suffering from a sense of malaise. The malaise was actually caused by a period of economic stagnation, exacerbated by political fatigue after Watergate, frustration with foreign relations, and a sort of come down from the wackiness of the 1960s. Now, by the time Sagan wrote his theory, the economy had recovered, at least for rich white people, in the 1980s and early 1990s. So that part of the quote-unquote malaise had lifted. But also, our dependence on consumer comforts had increased even more, causing a new wave of anxieties about the softening of American culture and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of this to say that Sagan's theories were very much informed by the culture that he himself lived in, more so than some deeply researched sociological or anthropological study of human nature or something along those lines.
Which actually brings us to where the historians come into all of this. Hopefully, as you've been listening to all these references to Christopher Columbus and the brave American pioneers, and the glories of exploration, you've been shouting at your phone or radio or whatever.
Your eyes have been rolling out of your head.
Rawr. Because as historians, we should immediately be critical of oversimplified references to human nature or to the American character or what have you. To state the obvious, it's not actually a great thing to compare space exploration to Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
And it's ahistorical to say that there is a monolithic American character that was developed through the process of pioneering westward to conquering Native Americans. Is Christopher Columbus really the way you want to sell the possibilities of space exploration? A man who at the very least kickstarted the deaths, oppression, and colonization of American peoples? Frederick Jackson Turner's description of Americans moving westward is also super reductive. I mean, the first thing we as historians should ask is, who does he consider Americans?
Right.
We're talking 1893, white guy. Take some guesses.
Right.
Because there were already Americans on the so-called frontier. Native Americans. And as I'm sure Elizabeth would remind us, the growth of the United States into what we recognize today didn't just happen from east to west.
Right.
It involved a significant amount of south to north migration and, of course, border changes, as we discussed in our episode on the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, as people who had previously been Mexican became Americans overnight as the border crossed them.
Right, not to mention the immigration that happened from west to east, as Asian immigrants arrived in California and moved in the opposite direction. And of course, we also need to remember that much of this quote-unquote brave pioneering was just enormous violence. White Americans didn't just move across the landscape of the United States in iconic wagon trains and Little House on the Prairie bonnets. The story of westward migration is a story of settler colonialism, where Native Americans were forcibly displaced, murdered in massacres like Sand Creek, Colorado. Wait a second. Murdered in massacres like those in Sand Creek, Colorado, Mankato, Minnesota, and Wounded Knee, South Dakota, where tribes and tribal lands broken up by the Dawes Act, and children ripped from parents and re-educated in boarding schools. Then, of course, is the issue that what the frontier meant or represented meant vastly different things to different groups of Americans and at different times across history. There was a time, for instance, when the open space of the American West represented to many people from the South an opportunity for extending the slave kingdom, a chance to further retrench and profit off of human bondage. What to one group is simply recalling the lost glories of the exploratory spirit is from another perspective, a call for oppression and domination. The call to explore space, like Columbus explored the New World, replicates a particular kind of white American worldview, one that completely disregards the fact that there might be more than one way of thinking about the actions and the legacy of Christopher Columbus.
And obviously, this is what historians and lots of folks in the humanities do. We problematize. This happens often on Twitter when Neil deGrasse Tyson will say something that he thinks is incredibly insightful.
Right.
That actually could be easily answered or solved by taking a humanities class. For instance, in September 2017, he tweeted, quote, "In school, rarely do we learn how data becomes facts, how facts become knowledge, and how knowledge becomes wisdom." In every historian's head, exploded.
Yes.
Especially all the history of science and history of medicine folks, because that's literally what they teach in school.
Yes.
I mean, this is easily dismissed as Neil deGrasse Tyson just being self-centered, but it also demonstrates how hyper-focused the sciences can be. And we can't really blame him in a way, after all, we're living in a moment when the STEM fields are treated like the solution to all the world's problems, including the economy, right?
Yeah.
In fact, there was just a study on NPR that found that more students are majoring in the STEM fields, even though they would rather major in a humanities field, and then aren't finding the jobs and salaries that are often promised in college marketing materials. In other words, they're majoring in STEM fields because they feel like it's the better economic choice, but they're then aren't getting those economic benefits. But anyhow, this is the goal of the humanities, to show that you can't make these sweeping generalizations about human nature. Carl Sagan was a straight-up genius, but even he made these broad claims about human nature, that humankind has this innate urge to wander that just aren't supported by historical knowledge, or at least rely on very out-of-date historical theories like the Turner thesis. It's more complicated than that. It's always more complicated
right.
than that.
Yeah. And this is sort of the irony of the space boosters using the image of the frontier to sell the space program. As they are trying to convince Americans that space is the final frontier, with the hopes that Americans will understand what they mean by frontier, historians are trying desperately to correct the record on the Turner thesis. Waves of revisionist history, all happening at the same time that, like, say, Carl Sagan is writing what he's writing in 1994, or like, you know, between, say, the late 60s and the early 90s.
Blue Dot is 94?
Yes.
Okay.
And he had written many books before that, right. But Blue Dot is 94.
Because he's like big in the 70s and 80s.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. So those waves of revisionist history from the 60s through to the 90s, and even happening now, of course, were starting to publish new Western histories, for instance, that showed that actually Turner was wrong, and so was his thesis. Mm-hmm. And just side note, FYI, revisionist history, not a bad thing. It's literally what we do. It's our day job. And I keep having these nightmares. Our very good friend and editor-in-chief at Nursing Cleo, Jacqueline Antonovich, is a historian of the American West, and I keep having these fears that I am interpreting all of this Western history wrong, and she is going to kill me. But Jackie, be kind. So, for instance, some historians in these waves of revisionist history asked what exactly Turner meant by frontier. He never actually defines the word. If it's vanishing, then what is it? Open space? Or is it a border? Is it a moving zone? Other historians argued that as Americans moved westward, they replicated the culture and the governance of the East Coast and were, as historian William Cronin has stated, models less of individualism than of dull conformity. Like, for instance, how does Turner explain cities in the Midwest and the West, right? Where do women or African Americans or Asian Americans fit into Turner's thesis? You can't really argue that they were given increased freedom or access to democracy just because they moved to the West. We know that's not true. All of these new histories were being written and published at the same time that those in the space world were trying to sell a static and simple idea of frontier to market space exploration.
As Howard McCurdy states very simply, the image of the frontier is America's creation myth. It's a story we tell ourselves, but not the reality of how our country was settled or how our national character, if there is such a thing, was forged. And historians weren't willing to sit around and let this myth be perpetuated. For instance, in 1982, when the space shuttle Columbia successfully landed, President Ronald Reagan stated that the successful end of this flight was, quote, the historical equivalent to the driving of the Golden Spike, which completed the first transcontinental railroad. Historian Patty Limerick called bullshit. I'm just going to quote here directly from Howard McCurdy. Quote, to meet the 1869 deadline, railroad workers laid the track so quickly that much of it had to be ripped up and replaced. Leland Stanford, representing Central Pacific, proved so unfamiliar with the elementary details of railroad construction that he could not drive the Golden Spike into the ground. The Union Pacific Railroad, half-sponsored to the transcontinental enterprise, went bankrupt 25 years later, and the Central Pacific tried to avoid payments on its government loans. Says Limerick, a reference to the Golden Spike to anyone who is serious about history is also a reference to enterprises done with too much haste and grandstanding and with too little care for detail. Not exactly what Reagan was going for when he compared the Columbia landing to that Golden Spike, huh?
No. And Reagan is known for these kind of sweeping references to history, right? He gives a speech about the grand vision of a city on a hill and sort of butchers this Puritan vision of America. This is one of his things.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, and you know, I'm just spitballing here, but maybe scientists should be required to take a couple of history classes. I'm just saying. I will make one last point on this issue. Just because we know that Turner's thesis was wrong doesn't mean that people didn't really believe it, right? There's a reason that Gene Roddenberry used the phrase space, the final frontier in the original series. We like to believe that Americans and humans too, maybe, have an innate need to explore and that we should explore outer space as an extension of that. We like to believe that it's inevitable, the natural next step in an ongoing human story. The mythological frontier is really entrenched in the American psyche, so all of this actually makes perfect sense. It's not as though these space boosters were maliciously lying to encourage exploration, but rather they didn't know what they didn't know. So one last point here. I mentioned that, you know, that NASA had these kind of plans, thinking that by the late 1980s, there would be permanent colonies on the moon. And I said that I would explain why, you know, this never happens. And McCurdy sort of, and maybe this is an over-explanation, but McCurdy sort of makes the argument that the boosters oversold and that the boosters' reliance on science fiction actually fills people's heads with a vision of the future that the space program isn't able to deliver on. And when the space program even though it was doing exciting things, once we have the moonshot, it becomes less clear, well, what do we do now? Because we had that iconic moment that made for great TV and people were very supportive of it. But then, you know, you get into the 70s and the economy sort of slows down and people are starting to think more like, well, what are we doing this for? Right. And then we have a couple of, you know, space exploration disasters like the Challenger explosion and the Columbia explosion that take sort of the steam out of it. Right. And so he makes this argument that it was actually our imagination that proves to be the space program's undoing. Because as we know, space exploration is not being funded really right now, or is being seriously underfunded, and is actually starting to go into private hands. Mm-hmm. That's why you mentioned Elon Musk earlier.
Right.
Because, you know, SpaceX is becoming the new wave of this exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not, but it's part of why that is because we kind of our imaginations got too big, right? And I think in a way, maybe SpaceX is trying to do that same thing over again by doing these kind of much more grand and what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of spectacular things and really selling, marketing it, right? Trying to get attention in the same way that the boosters were trying to do in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I find this, I loved doing this episode. I gotta tell you, this is so outside of things that I study, but I don't know why the Turner and the Turner thesis and the, kind of how it gets stuck into our brains. I just love, I think it's so fascinating and interesting. I teach it every time I teach US2. So by the time I sort of got into that, not to mention that I'm just interested in the history of science in general, this was just like, my brain was like exploding. I just loved it. but I also, as much as I'm like dunking on the science people here for like not paying attention to history and relying on these like overly broad narratives, mm-hmm. I mean, I think all of us sort of have that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a huge Trekkie myself. I'm a Trekkie sort of by marriage. So I am very familiar with the Star Trek universe. And even I, you know, you go to see even the new ones and mm-hmm. they have those grand scenes at the end where you see the Enterprise sort of floating in darkness and just stars and they go into the space, the final frontier. And you get that kind of warm fuzzies like, wow, like this is the future. Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, you say, like, does that make me a real American like Frederick Jackson the Turker? I mean, maybe in a way that is a myth that even when we know better, we still buy into.
Yeah.
You know?
I dig it.
Yeah.
If this episode has piqued your interest, we encourage you to check out the show notes at digpodcast.org, where you'll find all of our sources and a complete transcript if you want to read back through and see all the mistakes that we left into the copy.
Yes.
We appreciate your listens and your support.
I am going to link that video, the Disney video, mm-hmm. in the show notes, and I'm going to put into the copy some of those paintings by Chelsea Bonestell.
Absolutely. Make sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and Instagram at @dig_history. And if you're so moved, contribute to our Patreon account.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. This podcast was produced by the historians of Dig, Elizabeth Garner Masaryk, Sarah Hanley Cousins, Marissa Rhodes, and me, Avril Earls. Thanks for listening. Even before that, the major God damn it. The German
But the Tomorrowland segments were called segments. And if you know anything about the development of the United States.
Yep. There he goes. Space. The final frontier.
Okay. That's not at all like it, but okay. Here. Okay, are you good? Don't take any pictures of me.
Yeah,
it's hot in here. Your house is never hot.
It's just because we have the door closed.
I dressed for freezing today.
What you got under there?
Just a tank top.
Well, shake it out, girl.
Yeah, I can do that, but I didn't shave my armpits in like 5 years.
Okay, I'll be sure to get a close-up on your pits.
Fresh. No, I can't do it. You'll be horrified.
Yeah, usually.
Oh.
You changed your mind really quickly there.
I said, no, I can't do it, and I thought, oh, God, I have to. Okay, but so what I was trying to get you to say, which was not that.
Okay.
so cut all of this. Ellen?
To Candace Bergen? character?
Candace Bergen's not gay, and neither is her character on Murphy Brown. You're thinking of when Murphy Brown had a baby?
No, I don't know.
And she was a single mother, and it was like a huge but fucking thing. No, you're thinking of Ellen, because Ellen came out on her sitcom. But this is before the Ellen show.
Right.
Like the talk show.
Yes.
Yeah, you're thinking of Ellen.
Okay.
You've ruined this point.
Sorry. Start over.
Space. The final frontier.
I don't think that's Captain Kirk.